Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host, and today the topic of our discussion is cancer immunotherapy. We are joined by Dr. Lawrence Fong from UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. On the patient panel, to discuss the patient perspective, we have patient advocates Mike Scott, David Stanley, Joel Novak, and Amy Murash. Dr. Fong, great to have you with us, and welcome to Cure Talks.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Fong, you were part of the team that brought the first immunotherapy drugs from the labs to clinic. It would be great if you could talk a little bit about this fascination with the immune system and your journey in being able to treat cancer with your own immune system.
Well, my interest in focusing on cancer is a bit personal. My father died of cancer while I was in college, so I decided to go into medical school hoping to work on new treatments for this disease. And while I was in medical school, I actually became intrigued by the complexity and power of the immune system while taking the introductory immunology course during my first year in medical school. If the immune system could target certain types of infections with fine specificity, why couldn't we use it to treat cancer? And, at that time I was in med school, there were some immunotherapies just starting to make their way into the clinic, these cytokine therapies and cancer vaccines. And so, I decided for my research training in fellowship to really dive into this. And so I decided to work on immunotherapy for solid cancers, including prostate cancer. I recall one of my professors at the time telling me that, this approach would never work. Nevertheless, I worked with groups at Stanford, including Dr. Ed Engelman, on a dendritic cell vaccine for prostate cancer, and this ultimately became an FDA-approved therapy called Cyflucel-T or Provenge. When I moved to UCSF, we continued with our interest in immunotherapy, and I had a chance to work on the first in-human trial with another immunotherapy. This was an anti-CTLA-4 antibody, which is now called ipilimumab and is also FDA-approved. And, since that time, there have been other therapies really making their way into clinic, especially these anti-PD-1 antibodies that we've worked on, and it's been a very wild ride ever since.
So it has probably taken decades of basic research to understand the fundamentals, of our immune systems, and then probably overlay on them the fundamentals of cancer, and then further overlay how the two of these things work together, and then try to come up with a solution. It's truly fascinating. Do you think this is the penicillin moment for cancer?
Wow. Yes and no. Yes, in that, our approach to treating cancer is forever changed, not unlike when penicillin came out. Just as patients with bacterial infections now receive antibiotics, I think the majority of cancer patients in the future will receive immunotherapy. In fact, we now teach our medical students about cancer immunotherapy in their introductory class as they actually start out in medical school. So it's really changed our way of thinking. Unfortunately, the challenge is that our current immunotherapies do not work as well as penicillin. Only 10 to 30% of our cancer patients, benefit with our current immunotherapies when they work. For those patients, they may have very durable responses, including some folks being cured. Our challenge is now to get immunotherapies to work in more people.
Dr. Fong, I'm going to ask quite a broader question here. So could you please talk about some of the most effective cancer immunotherapies that we know today?
Well, there are three areas where immunotherapy has had great success. at this point. And, you know, those are immune checkpoint inhibition, bispecific antibodies, and the third are CAR T-cell therapies. You know, with immune checkpoint inhibitors, these are the antibodies that target CTLA-4 or PD-1 or its receptor PD-L1. You know, these different molecules are essentially brakes on the immune system, and by giving these antibodies, we're blocking those brakes so that we can turn or revive the immune system to target the cancer. These antibodies can lead to responses in a broad range of cancer, and the list of approvals where we can administer these drugs is getting longer by the day, it seems. We've also found that combining these checkpoint inhibitors, such as anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4, we can actually see better response rates in certain diseases, such as, you know, melanoma and kidney cancer, and for some lung cancers. With regards to that second area, bispecific antibodies, these are drugs where one end of the drug targets the cancer cell and the other end targets the immune system. By pulling these immune cells into the tumors, we're banking on these immune cells killing the tumors. And in fact, we've got a drug already FDA approved for B-cell malignancies that does this. You know, the third area are these CAR T cells, or what are called chimeric antigen receptor T cells. With this treatment, we take immune cells out of a patient. We actually engineer those cells so that they have a receptor that targets the cancer cell, and then we give those cells back to the patient. So these immune cells are now hardwired to recognize the cancer. And we now have multiple CAR T cells approved that are targeting B cell leukemias and lymphomas.
Dr. Fong, since you're mentioning, you've already just mentioned CAR T cells, I'm going to take an audience question on this. The person who's listening wants to know, can T cell therapies be used against common solid tumors?
Well, right now, that's a very active area of investigation. You know, as I mentioned, the CAR T cells that we currently have approved target B cell malignancy. So these are leukemias and lymphomas. With regards to solid tumors, that's proved to be a bigger challenge. And, you know, one of the challenges is actually finding a good target on a solid tumor. And there are multiple groups that are working on this. And, you know, groups are also looking at ways where we don't rely on just one protein, but we might rely on integrating recognition of multiple proteins to target and kill a tumor cell. The other element is with regards to solid tumors, the tumors themselves are very inhospitable for immune cells, and so we're also thinking about ways to make these CAR T cells resistant to those suppressive mechanisms so that they actually work better there. And so this would be an area that I'd really recommend staying tuned as these new cell therapies come into the clinic.
Absolutely. So we have another question on the same lines on CAR T and engineering of the genes for these re-engineered T cells. So the person wants to know, can Dr. Fong talk about CRISPR and how it can help cancer immunotherapy?
Yeah, so you know, CRISPR is a new way to edit genes in cells. And, you know, CRISPR therapies are being developed to target specific cell types within the body. CRISPR has also been used to engineer cells outside the body. In this context, you know, taking out, for instance, T cells and editing in a receptor that's targeting the tumors. And so this is a new technology that's just made its way into the clinic. And, you know, over time, I think as we learn more how to use CRISPR, we'll more than likely see this being used in more and more clinical trials. And it should make engineering of the cells easier than the methods that we use today.
Thank you, Dr. Fong. Going back to our initial trail of questions, we were talking about checkpoint inhibitors and CAR T cells. So as you said, Doctor, immune therapy does not work for all tumors. So it follows that other drugs can combine with immunotherapies. So it would be great if you could talk a little bit about the impact of immunotherapies on the scope of combination therapies.
Yeah, so you know, I mentioned briefly that we're now combining anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1 for some cancers. You know, really an area of active research is identifying other immunotherapies that we can combine together, including combining with these existing antibodies that we have. But, you know, importantly, we've also found that we can combine immunotherapies with our conventional cancer treatments, such as chemotherapies and targeted therapies. As it turns out, these cancer therapies that we've used for years can also affect the immune system. And so now we actually use a combination of an anti-PD-1 antibody with chemotherapy for the first-line treatment in lung cancer, and we're also now able to use that in some breast cancers. With regards to targeted therapies, we have these drugs that target blood vessels, what we call tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or TKIs. What we found is you can actually use these drugs to combine with anti-PD-1 antibodies. And this is now an FDA-approved frontline therapy for kidney cancer. And so as we learn how other cancer treatments modify the immune system, we're looking forward to more and more combinations with immunotherapies in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Fong. So what do you see? I know you're talking about combination therapies and targeted therapies. So what do you see as the next major milestones in cancer immunotherapy, say, over the next 5 years? And we'd also like to know about the programs at UCSF Helen Diller Center that patients should keep track of.
Yeah, so you know, over the next 5 years, I hope that we'll see new drugs targeting other immune pathways gaining traction. Right now, a lot of interest is around the immune checkpoints, but there clearly are other pathways that are also incredibly important. And, you know, as we get more of those drugs available, this will add to our treatment toolkit going forward. Second, I think our understanding and our ability to identify who can respond to these immunotherapies will improve over the next 5 years. And so, you know, this is important for us to not only give our existing immunotherapies to patients who we believe to respond, but it would also be important for us to be able to select and identify patients who might need combination therapies or other treatments added to their immunotherapy. You know, ultimately, we'd love to be able to tailor immunotherapy to each patient, this idea of, you know, precision cancer treatment. And I think, you know, that would be possible in immunotherapy as well. Finally, you know, I think over that time frame, we'll see CAR T cells and bispecific antibodies that will work on more cancers. You know, right now, we only have those treatments approved for B-cell malignancies, as we talked about. But I think, you know, over the next 5 years, we'll see that broaden out to other diseases. In terms of your question about the Cancer Immunotherapy Program at UCSF. This is a program that is focused on bringing new immunotherapies into the clinic. Historically, cancer centers and programs had focused programs on where the cancer arises from. So, for instance, from the lung or from the breast or from the prostate. Our program actually is focused on the treatment modality, which is using the immune system to treat cancer, because there are specific considerations in how we can administer these safely, as well as how we can get them to work better. And so within this program, we have clinical trials that span different diseases. You know, this includes new checkpoint inhibitors, vaccines, bispecifics, and cell therapies. You know, our mission is to learn as much as we can from each person that we care for. And so to realize that vision, we have clinical and laboratory researchers integrated into this immunotherapy program. What that allows us to do is to perform cutting-edge research on samples from our patients, and, you know, really to tease out what these immunotherapies are doing in people with cancer. I'm often asked by people I'm caring for how their immune system is responding to the treatment. We hope with further research that we'll be able to answer these questions in the future, and that these types of discoveries will help guide new immunotherapies and new immunotherapy combinations. And so, you know, it really is a program that has multiple clinical trials going on now, and we have over 20 clinical trials, but we also have a pipeline of even more trials that we'll be activating. But importantly, we hope to not only be administering these treatments, but again, really advancing the field with new discoveries.
Oh, that sounds really interesting, Dr. Fong. I'm going to actually stop my questions now and let the panel take over. Before that, I want to just take one question from the audience. The person wants to know, we have been reading about cancer vaccines. In fact, Stanford has a human trial on for vaccines. Dr. Fong, where do we stand with respect to vaccines for cancer?
So right now, the only FDA-approved cancer vaccine for treating patients with cancer is Cipilucel-T or Provenge, and that's FDA-approved for men with advanced metastatic prostate cancer. You know, there are studies now focused on a whole host of different vaccines. That vaccine that I described targets a protein that's expressed on prostate cancer, and so it can be administered to a broad range of prostate cancer patients. But one area of research now that's quite active, and we also have you know, multiple clinical trials studying this at UCSF, is to use customized vaccines. And so in this approach, what we do is using a biopsy from a patient, and that could either be one that was done in the past or one that we do for the clinical trial. We actually sequence that individual's cancer to understand what types of mutations are present within that cancer. And because these mutations only arise in the cancer, we think that these would actually make great targets for a vaccine. And so with this sequence information, the companies that we're working with on these vaccines basically create a specific vaccine for that specific individual, so it's customized. And so that vaccine is given to an individual, and it's usually given in combination with a checkpoint inhibitor. And so right now we have a couple of those clinical trials going on at UCSF. I think, you know, this is an area of, you know, very active investigation, And, you know, I would also recommend staying tuned as we get more and more experience with this approach.
Absolutely. So with that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hand it over to David. David Stanley is a writer, teacher, actor, and narrator. His book on melanoma, titled Melanoma, It Started with a Freckle, is available on Amazon. David, over to you.
Thank you, Priya. Dr. Fong, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a couple questions for you. Priya, if this is the way we're going to do this, I'll ask like my two or three questions and we'll move on to the next guest.
Yes.
Okay. So in the melanoma community, one of the big issues that a lot of the patients are having with the checkpoint inhibitors like Keytruda and Opdivo are the side effects. And you know that some of them are just so devastating that even though the patients are getting good results from those checkpoint inhibitors, they have to stop treatment. Looking forward, what kinds of things are you thinking about in your lab to help ameliorate some of those horrible side effects that the checkpoint inhibitors kick off?
Now, this is a terrific question. This is one of the risks when we turn on the immune system to fight the cancer. We also turn on the immune system that might lead to the immune system attacking some of these other tissues. And, within our research program here, we actually are studying this. Whereby, we're taking blood samples from patients starting with these checkpoint inhibitors, and if they were to develop the toxicities, we'd again get blood samples from them, but also if there's an area that's being involved with this side effect, we actually take a biopsy of that, and in doing so, what we can do is finally dissect out what the immune system is actually seeing in these tissues. At this point in time, we don't actually know that very basic question. And we don't know whether these side effects that we're seeing are the same as diseases that we see. So for instance, if people develop diarrhea, is this the same as inflammatory bowel disease or colitis? Or is this completely different? And so this is a very active area of research at UCSF, and we're really trying to tease this apart, again, trying to learn as much as we can from every person that we treat. The other component is we actually have a team of specialists that deal with these different side effects. You know, this is a really new area in medicine, and so we have specialists that are focused in each organ that these side effects can arise in. And we basically have a referral clinic to help manage these patients. So if you go on to our website, which is immunotherapy.ucsf.edu, there's actually a link there to our specialists who are focused on helping to manage as well as helping to research why these side effects arise.
That's information then that I can take back to the melanoma community and share with them, because it's a big concern. I have two more questions, if I could. First of all, I know you do some work with BioAlta, and they're doing some interesting stuff. Could you talk for a little bit about conditionally active biologics? It sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, so we actually just had a publication on this about a month or two ago. The idea here is when you give an immune checkpoint inhibitor, these antibodies basically go throughout the body. And in fact, when we use radiographic imaging to look at the distribution of these antibodies, they're in the spleen and in the lymph nodes and in the lungs and in the liver. They're all over the place in addition to being in the tumor. And so the idea is rather than having these antibodies turn on the immune system everywhere in the body, could we actually direct that to the specific tumor site? And in doing so, could we actually get these get these to work better. And, you know, what we found in preclinical models is, indeed, you can actually not only maintain anti-tumor responses, so you can basically shrink tumors in these preclinical models, you can actually avoid some of the side effects in these preclinical models. And so, you know, this company, as well as others, are thinking about actually moving those into the clinic and have actually moved them into the clinic. And so that's another area that I would really, you know, suggest staying tuned, in that, you know, if we can really improve that therapeutic index by either maintaining or improving clinical responses, but avoid some of the side effects, that would also represent a significant advance.
Okay, last question. Oddly enough, I'm actually teaching some of this to my high school seniors in biology as we speak. They have a test tomorrow. I'm here in Michigan. I'm a Michigan State grad, and I live in Michigan, and I follow Dr. Neubig's work on the RNA transcription inhibitors. And I know you might not be comfortable talking about somebody else's work, especially so early on, but could you explain it for us a little bit and then talk about maybe some comparisons between its potential versus some of the work that you're doing in immunotherapy?
Well, you know, our RNA is basically the message with which cells produce proteins and work. And so it basically gives a cell a program on how to work. And as you might imagine, you know, targeting RNAs through different approaches really allow us another way to reprogram a cell. And so if you think about a cell as being, you know, the computer, the RNA, you know, represents the software. And so I think, you know, there are many ways now that people are looking at using RNA so that you can reprogram the cells that can either help to stimulate an immune response, or it could serve as means by which you could actually turn off pathways that you think might be impacting the immune response. And so it's really a wide open field here, and another exciting area that you know, hopefully we'll see developing into therapies that hit the clinic.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Fong. I'm going to pass it along to whoever's next on the panel. I appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Next, we have Joel Noah. Joel is founder of Cancer ABCs and a survivor of 5 primary cancer. Joel, you're live.
Hello. Yes, I'm here. How are you? Thank you so much, Dr. Fong. We appreciate your presentation. I actually want to do a little bit of a follow-up question to David's excellent question about side effects. Many people have autoimmune illnesses, arthritic conditions, and things of that order. And if you're taking off the brakes of the immune system, isn't that going to create a conflict or a problem for people? Should people with autoimmune illnesses even consider some of these immunologic therapies?
That's also a terrific question. The clinical trials that we perform on folks with these immunotherapies exclude patients with autoimmune disease. And so as a result, you know, information that we have from these clinical trials on autoimmune disease patients is lacking. What's happened as these therapies are now FDA approved is that, you know, physicians can now, you know, decide how best to use these drugs and whether or not trying these treatments in folks with autoimmune disease might be appropriate. This is something that is really evolving now, and it is evolving in medical practice. And I think it's critically important for patients to really consult with their physicians to see whether or not it would be appropriate, because the concern is that by removing the brakes, you would potentially make the autoimmune disease worse. Now, if an individual has a distant history of autoimmune disease that is not active, that might be a different scenario than somebody who has active autoimmune disease at the time that they also need their immunotherapy. But I think, you know, this is really a critical question that individuals need to take up with their physicians on a case-by-case basis, because, again, we don't have a lot of experience based on the clinical trials done thus far.
Right. Thank you. And just to make sure it's clear, and I think you said it, but still, that if anyone does have an autoimmune illness or is concerned about that, they need to really make sure that their doctor knows about that and that enters into the conversation. I would ask you if you could clarify something. Oftentimes I find when I talk to patients, there's some confusion under the concept or the word vaccine when it comes to immunologic therapy. Most of us, or many of us, think of vaccines as something that will stop a disease, but you mentioned that syphilis T is a vaccine, but it's only given to men who already have prostate cancer. Could you clarify that a little, please?
Yeah. So most of the vaccines that we use in medicine are prevention vaccines. And so, you know, the pediatric vaccines for measles, as an example, these aren't to treat measles. It's actually to prevent individuals from getting that infection. And so, you know, in the context of cancer, we have not gotten to that point of giving an immunotherapy that's targeting the cancer to prevent the development of cancer. There are some vaccines targeting viruses such as the hepatitis virus, as well as human papillomavirus. People who have chronic infections with those viruses are susceptible to liver cancer, to cervical cancer, and we have those infectious disease vaccines. But we really don't have a cancer vaccine now that targets the actual cancer cells before a patient develops it. And so this is where the Sipilucel-T that we talked about, that is a vaccine, but in this context, we're using it not to prevent prostate cancer, but to actually treat the prostate cancer. And as you might imagine, administering a vaccine when a person already has the disease may be a bit more challenging. And so this is why that vaccine is, you know, being studied in combination with other immunotherapies, but also new vaccines are being studied that are also trying to trigger immune responses. I think the other element is, rather than giving these immunotherapies to people with metastatic cancer, that we should actually administer these vaccines earlier to people with a more limited disease. And so, in fact, that's what's going on now with Sipilucel-T, where men with localized prostate cancer are getting that vaccination as part of a clinical trial. But I think, you know, this is something that hopefully, as vaccines gain more traction, we'll see them being studied in earlier states of disease.
Thank you so much, Prior. I think I'll go ahead and let somebody else jump in at this point. Thank you so much for your answers.
Okay, thank you.
Next to the panel is Amy Marash. Amy is a stage 4 colon cancer survivor and a retired TV camera woman. Her book of full-color cartoons and drawings about her cancer experience, titled Cancer is So Funny, is available on Amazon. So, Amy, you're live. Please ask your questions.
Hi. Yes, thank you very much. And Dr. Fong, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I'm really sorry the new therapies came too late for your father, but I'm glad you're working on them. I guess I'm particularly interested in the patient experience and the caregiver experience. And so, you know, you said right at the outset, this has been a very wild ride. And I assume you mean not only for clinicians, but for patients and family. and families. But I'd just like to offer, from my perspective, I was recruited for clinical trials in quite a while ago, in 2009 when I had active cancer, and 2010 when I was in remission. But at the time, I was so overwhelmed by my cancer diagnosis that I really did not understand the trial. And I know how to read. I'm not a real good listener. But, you know, I absolutely didn't even realize till I was halfway through the trial that I might be receiving a placebo in my particular trial. And I'm sure it was explained to me, but I didn't know it. And so I guess what I'd like to ask you is, what kind of support do you give your patients who are considering entering a clinical trial about the risks and or costs and benefits of participating? And do they have a patient advocate or someone to help them choose, you know, should they have treatment when the success rate is, you know, small? Should they travel for a treatment? And, you know, personally, I know they told me that my experimental drug probably wouldn't benefit me, but, you know, I didn't believe that. And so what do you do? Is there any independent person who would help a cancer patient in evaluating, is this trial for me?
That's also a really great question, and you know, you're absolutely right. When I you know, talk with our fellows in the clinic as we go in to talk with a patient, I tell our fellows, you know, that the patients are really gonna remember, if you're lucky, you know, a third of what we're actually going to talk about. And so this is critically important to repeating critical points, including, you know, if it's related to a clinical trial, but really spending the time to make sure that questions are answered. And so within our cancer immunotherapy team, you know, it's not just an individual physician that would be interacting with the patient. It's really a team that includes a research coordinator, a research nurse, a research nurse practitioner, navigators within the clinic to help with, you know, all the different processes and things to consider on the clinical trials, including financial implications. With regards to, you know, having advocates, you know, I think that's a really great idea. At UCSF, you know, what we do have are support groups where, you know, people from the community basically participate and share their experiences, and that sometimes is a forum where people can present the different options. But I think, you know, the critical part is, you know, when we convey all this information, again, we need to really take the time and really need to emphasize, you know, those critical elements that you highlight. And, you know, this is something that, especially with the complexity of these immunotherapies, we're really giving people we're caring for, you know, a crash course in immunology in addition to everything else. And so it's really making sure that everybody is aware of what we're doing and, you know, what the risks are. And so I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it's a great, I mean, I appreciate it. You know, I would add to that, I mean, I love that you said, you know, they remember a third. I never batted that high. I mean, even when I go for checkups, I don't bat that high. But, you know, it's a great start. And I did work in a cancer center for about 4 years doing arts and medicine. And I found that, and this is, you know, an NIH majorly funded cancer center, that many of the patients had talked to, you know, the navigator or the social worker on their first day of diagnosis or their first day of infusion or whatever. And then when they kind of got their heads together and got sort of used to dealing with their situation, there was no, you know, many weeks later, then, you know, their consciousness would come awake and that have some questions. So, you know, I think maybe, you know, if you think of a cancer center as a money-making enterprise, you know, how much money is going to go into the patient experience? I mean, I know that's not up to you. That's up to administrators, and I appreciate your efforts in educating people. And you're right, you know, for my cancer was colon cancer, and there's a phenomenal forum called Colon Club that you can go online and listen and read, and you can log in and register. You can just read around on that site, and there's a lot of very, very, very informed, I don't know what you call them, posts or threads about immunotherapy. Anyhow, I think that was more or less, let me see what I wanted to ask.
So Amy, you know,
Amy,
to your point, you know, about, you know, the patient's experience, you know, one of the things at UCSF is we have a new cancer clinic building that is opening in the next few months. And, you know, from the get-go, that building was purpose-built really around, you know, the patient experience, exactly as you're describing. And as you know, for folks that are receiving cancer care, you spend a lot of time within a clinic receiving treatments or waiting. And, you know, part of that building and a lot of the space is dedicated for patients so that they can spend their time either learning about their disease or learning about new treatments, or, you know, spending their time in other ways that they choose. But I think, you know, your point about focusing on what people experience is really a critical one. And I think, you know, certainly the cancer centers are changing that way. And at UCSF, this new building is really with that in mind.
That is great to hear. I mean, that is really great to hear, and I appreciate that. I guess for you, I would ask what the challenge would be when you don't actually know the risks. In other words, maybe we'll try one of these immunotherapies with a patient that looks like it might be helpful, and then, maybe do you have enough data to even be able to tell someone? And, you know, I know it's very individual, but, you know, this sort of your mileage may vary, you know, well, this might work for you, but it might immediately do that to you, or 2 years down the road, it might do some other thing.
Yeah, these are all things that when people come to learn about the clinical trials we offer, we try to do, you know, the best we can in informing folks of the risks. But as you point out, sometimes this is the first time a treatment's actually gone into a person, and, you know, in those situations, you know, we try to use the science and the preclinical data to give us a sense of, you know, the potential risks that are there. But, you know, everybody who goes on to the trials, you know, has to understand that there's going to be unknowns as part of the trial. That's the very nature of the clinical trial. And this is where having our team be hyper vigilant for, you know, things that are out of the ordinary is critically important in that, you know, we might recognize a new side effect, and you know, that's something that we need to be very vigilant about.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you, Dr. Fong. We can just open this up for some audience questions now. I've been receiving emails since we started our show, and we've taken a couple of them. We'll probably take a look at a few others as well. Dr. Fong, one of our listeners wants to know that she says she read recently that intake of probiotics makes immunotherapy less effective in cancer. Is this true?
Ooh, the area of probiotics and the microbiome are really a hot area of research right now. You know, the thought is, you know, with probiotics, you basically alter the bacteria that are in your body, including in your gut. And, you know, there's emerging data that shows that depending on what types of bacteria are in your gut, that may actually alter your chances of responding to an immunotherapy. And as your listener points out, there also is some data that, you know, people who've received probiotics actually have a lower response rate. I think, you know, this information needs to be confirmed, and, you know, there needs to be more people studied in order to determine these effects. But I think, you know, in the meantime, since there's so much that we don't know about the probiotics and, you know, how best to modify the microbiome, I would recommend to your listeners, if they're interested in this type of an approach, to really do this in the context of a study. Because, you know, sometimes even though people might think probiotics as a whole might be a good thing, this is an example where it may not actually be a good thing. And, you know, we'd really want that to be, you know, formally studied and documented. And so, again, my recommendation to the listeners would be, if you're interested in probiotics or changing your microbiome, to really try to participate in a study so that it can be looked at and there's a rationale behind what we're doing.
Thank you, Dr. Fong. The next question is, are there immunotherapies working for colon cancer that has metastasized to other organs? And if so, what are they?
Well, you know, with regards to colon cancer, we now know that colon cancer can come in a few different flavors. And there's one flavor of colon cancer where there's, you know, alterations in the DNA repair mechanisms, and we call that MSI high colon cancer. For those individuals, we have an anti-PD-1 antibody that's FDA approved and has a very high response rate in the setting of colon cancer. Unfortunately, that's a minority of folks, and so the majority of folks will not have that mutation or alteration in their cancer. For the majority of folks that don't have MSI high, right now, you know, this is a very active area of research with regards to immunotherapies. And so there are, you know, vaccine trials and bispecific trials and other trials that are going on in colorectal cancer. And so this would be something where, you know, we don't have the answer yet. But again, I would stay tuned as these newer approaches are underway and give us a sense of whether or not they're working for people who don't have MSI high colon cancer.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Fong. We have David with another question. Yes, David, please go ahead.
One more question, Dr. Fong. I've read a couple of your papers and a couple of the abstracts, and I know that a lot of your early work focused on prostate cancers. That's your natural field of interest. Well, my natural field of interest as a melanoma survivor is melanoma, and I'm curious how, kind of explain to the layman, how we can extrapolate the immunotherapy that you've been working on for over the years with prostate cancer, how we can extrapolate that into melanoma care.
Yeah, so, you know, melanoma and prostate cancer are very different cancers. You know, as you're aware, you know, melanoma arises in areas that often are sun exposed, and as a result, there's a lot of mutations that are there within that cancer. In contrast, prostate cancer actually has a very low number of mutations, and so as a result, the pool of targets that the immune system can see is actually less than it is in melanoma. And so, you know, with regards to thinking about these two diseases, you know, we really need to think about how the immune system is actually seeing these cancers on their own. And so in this context, an immune system might be better able to see a melanoma rather than a prostate cancer. I think, you know, the other component is we know that the prostate and prostate cancer are very immunosuppressive. And, you know, this really creates a challenge. Even if you have an immune cell that can see the prostate cancer, when it gets to the cancers, when it gets to the tumors, it can unfortunately get shut down by a lot of different mechanisms besides PD-1. And, you know, some of these mechanisms actually are more than likely also relevant in the context of melanomas, particularly those melanomas that are resistant to our existing immunotherapies. And so I think, you know, this is where some of these observations that we can learn in prostate cancer may actually help guide us in other cancers that are more difficult to treat or are resistant to our immunotherapies. And, you know, the hope is that some of these might be applicable to other difficult-to-treat cancers, such as, you know, colorectal cancer, as we talked about as well. You know, this is, again, another very active area of research, and hopefully we'll get a better picture of that as we learn more.
Thank you, Dr. Fong. That was very interesting. Appreciate that.
Thank you, David. Dr. Fong, I've received quite a few questions wanting to know the status of cancer immunotherapies in breast cancer.
Yeah, so breast cancer has been another disease that has been challenging with regards to the immunotherapies. And you know, again, as we talked about in colorectal cancer, breast cancer actually comes in quite a few different flavors. As it turns out, we now have an approved therapy for breast cancer, which combines an anti-PD-L1 antibody called atezolizumab with chemotherapy. And for women with that specific flavor of breast cancer, particularly if their breast tumors have this PD-L1 protein in the tumor, using this immunotherapy is now actually approved for that breast cancer. For, you know, other flavors of breast cancer, we do see some responses with these anti-PD-1 antibodies, but those rates of response are not very high. I think this is where, you know, a lot of interest in the field is thinking about combinations that could enable these immunotherapies to work. I think another area of excitement is actually using these immunotherapies earlier in breast cancer. And so in research that's actually, you know, pioneered at UCSF with Laura Esserman's group and the I-SPY program, immunotherapies have actually shown to have good activity when given prior to surgery for breast cancer. And so this would argue that perhaps giving immunotherapy earlier in breast cancer may actually also significantly improve response rates. And so now there are clinical trials that are focused specifically on that. And so that's another area that I think we should see a significant progress over the next few years.
Thank you, Dr. Fong. We just have time for two more questions, and then we can wrap up for today. The first one is there a movement to break out of the traditional data collection for clinical trials to allow for patients who might not qualify for a trial to try a drug without it corrupting a data set, thereby allowing for more experimentation? It's a long one.
Yeah, no, this is a very challenging question. And, this really speaks to cancer not being one disease, but really, you know, hundreds and thousands of different subtypes of cancer. And unfortunately, if you have a rare cancer or a rare variant of a cancer, you may not qualify for a clinical trial. And, at this point in time, the way clinical trials are approved and run, we have to be able to define the specific patient population that we're treating on those trials. I think, the hope is that as we get more therapies approved and available within this, treatment toolkit that I alluded to, we may be able to customize treatment for people with rare cancers. But at the present time, we don't have enough of an understanding to help guide us in selecting treatment for many of the cancers. And unfortunately, the numbers of drugs that are now approved in that toolkit is still fairly limited. But, the hope is that as we really learn more about the different cancers and how they may be immunologically similar to others, I think that would really give us an opportunity to broaden out these immunotherapies to these rare tumors.
Thank you, Dr. Fong. The last question, and then it's a wrap for us today. The listener wants to know, aside from the scientific challenges, what are the top barriers in bringing cancer immunotherapies to patients?
Well, this is also a really big question. I think the barriers are many. I think part of it is access to these immunotherapies and clinical trials. A part of that is the cost, even for the approved immunotherapies, are quite substantial. That's also a very broad issue that, is hard to address in 30 seconds. But I think, this is something that, immunotherapy in my mind is here to stay. And the hope is that even, despite these barriers, it'll be available to more and more patients as we address these barriers.
Thank you, Dr. Fong. As we continue to learn much more about how immunotherapy works and about the immune system as a whole and develop a better understanding, I think it may make it more likely that we will discover new immunotherapies that could potentially be used to treat all cancer. So, Dr. Fong, thank you so very much for sharing all this information on the latest immunotherapy treatment options and research with us today. David, Joel, and Amy, thanks a lot for your participation and bringing the patient's perspective into the discussion. Mike Scott, who was part of our panel today, could not make it. He just emailed apologizing because got caught in a traffic accident. Luckily, nothing untoward has happened. It's just a few scratches. That's what he said. So he wanted to apologize to Dr. Fong for not being here today. and the panel as well. So we thank UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center and the audience for all the support today. And this talk will be available on curetalks.com. So please visit our website for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone, and have a great evening. Thank you, Dr. Fong. Thank you.
Thank you.